Hello and welcome. Longtime listeners of mine will recognize my next guest. Mike Fouché from HeatRising.net is on this episode of The Cole Memo. I am your host, Cole Preston. Every episode is released in audio, video, and transcript format. To find the transcript, audio, or video version of any episode, please refer to the description of the episode that you're listening to now. Within that description, you can find a link which will take you to our website, which will display the transcript for this episode and the platforms where you can find this episode in audio or video formats. If you're unable to locate the episode description on whichever platform you're listening from, simply take note of the episode number and visit thecolememo.com. From there, you can use the search functionality in the top right-hand corner to find the corresponding episode, and then you'll be able to access the audio, video, and transcript version of that episode. You might also find any links that we reference during the episode so that you might be able to do your own research. If you're not listening to this episode of The Cole Memo on Patreon, then you are listening to this episode later than our patrons. To become a patron, go to thecolememo.com/Patreon. It's a great way to support our show, and it gives you access to our episodes as they air for only $3 a month. Another way to support our show is by going to thecolememo.com/support. From there, you can make a one-time, monthly, or yearly contribution of your choice. That's right. You can donate a dollar once, monthly, or yearly. If you donated a dollar once monthly, you would donate $12 a year. And trust me, every little bit counts. Our show is funded by listeners like you. It costs a lot to make this show between hosting fees, distribution fees, equipment, the costs of equipment, et cetera, et cetera. It all adds up. So any way you're able to support is greatly appreciated. One of the best ways to support our show is actually free. Subscribe to or follow our show. Leave us a positive review from wherever you are listening to us from. Favorite this episode. Give it a thumbs up. Leave a comment or post a review. I think I mentioned reviews twice, so you can see how important that is to us. Your engagement and support is appreciated. Today is February 29th, 2024. Enjoy this episode of The Cole Memo. Once again, folks, sitting down with Mike Fouché from HeatRising.net. Really quick, if you go to HeatRising.net, in the top right-hand corner, all you have to do is click subscribe, and you can get this news sent right to your inbox. Mike, go ahead and introduce yourself to our audience.
Hey, I'm Mike Fouché. I'm a longtime journalist, but before that, I worked in politics. I worked on Capitol Hill. I worked in the Clinton administration. I worked in the U.S. Department of Energy. And a whole bunch of stuff in Illinois too. And in the last year and a half, I've picked up a dream of always that I always had of covering and reporting on climate issues. And this last year, I've traveled as an accredited reporter to the major climate negotiations in Dubai, and I plan on doing that again in the next year. Which will be in fabulous Baku, Azerbaijan. We can get into why that's going to be interesting a little later. I run Heat Rising, which is a newsletter that I've started that covers basically global climate politics. And so there's a lot of stuff about climate issues and the science of climate. But what I'm trying to talk about is why countries do what they do and what the whole struggle is as the green economy takes over from a lot of the fossil stuff.
Yep. And once again, it's heatrising.net for our listeners. Definitely go and check it out. I'm a subscriber. You should be too. There's a lot of good news that comes through. So where do you want to start today? You know, you did mention you just went to Dubai. That was one of the things I thought I wanted that I would be interesting to chat about. We also have some really interesting data, so I want to follow your lead. Where do you want to start today?
Well, we could talk about the climate negotiations. Cool. So, you know, the United Nations hosts a meeting of 198 parties, not countries, because some of the people that participate are not really countries, like the Vatican. And actually the Palestinians have a representative group. But it's all of these different organizations from around the world, and they get together and they negotiate over exactly how we should be moving forward with climate. And there's a lot of tiny little issues that go into it. But this year, the big struggle was, are we going to set a date certain for when we're going to stop using fossil fuels? And so what's miraculous about these meetings is that they are 100% consensual. They never passed rules about what exactly it takes in order to have a decision if it's not consensual. So that means that everyone has to at least not disagree. They don't have to agree, but they have to not disagree. And that's a very fine line there. And so you have essentially a situation where if some country wants to wreck the whole proceedings, they can just say, I disagree, and that's it. But the result is that you end up, even though it's not as ambitious as we'd like it to be, the result is that you get something that everybody in the world agrees to, which is actually kind of a miraculous thing. And while this meeting did not end up with an agreement on a date certain when we're going to stop using fossil fuels, it did, for the first time, have a statement where everybody in the world, including countries that produce a lot of oil, like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Nigeria, and the United States, all agree that fossil fuels are the cause of climate change. And I know that sounds like a no-duh kind of thing, but for countries that have all of their politics and all of their well-being sunk into oil and natural gas, this is a huge deal. Like if fossil fuel use went away tomorrow, Saudi Arabia would have a revolution and a lot of people would die. And this would happen in a lot of places. So this was an incredible agreement. It was an amazing thing. And there were a number of other big, big things that happened in Dubai too. And this all happens over the course of 2 weeks. You know, the first week, you get a lot of big leaders that come. King Charles was there. And, you know, so were most of the leaders of Europe. And you didn't have Joe Biden. You didn't have Xi Jinping from China, or Xi Jinping. From China, but you did have Prime Minister Modi from India. You did have Lula da Silva from Brazil. So there are a lot of important leaders that are there in the first week. And then all the leaders go away and the real negotiations set in. And this, by the way, is after a week of crazy activity. And the second week, everyone's pretty exhausted. And it always is supposed to end on a certain day. Never ends on a certain day, and usually goes for at least one, maybe two extra days. And everyone is up until 4 a.m. for days in a row. Reporters, negotiators, and it's exhausting. And then you end up with a statement, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. This time it had a lot of good, and it didn't have enough. And there are certain countries who felt like it wasn't enough, but they didn't block it because it was as much as they felt that they could get out of the rest of the world.
That's super interesting. So you're saying, if I could recap, one of the big highlights is for the first time, everybody at this meeting, for lack of better words, summit, what would we call it?
You can call it any of those.
Yeah. Everybody agreed, nobody disagreed that fossil fuels are the cause of climate change.
Yeah. And then after that, it said, we need to start stepping down. We need to start moving away from using fossil fuels. And the expectation is that, okay, now that we've done this, we're going to start coming up with, in future years, other things to say, okay, what are we going to eliminate? And there's a big push to say we're going to start eliminating coal. And the United States, coal use has been declining very rapidly, mostly because all these other methods like natural gas and solar and wind are a lot cheaper than coal. But China and India have been ramping up their use of coal, mostly because there's a lot of coal. They have a lot of coal in their countries. They don't want to have to pay other people for fuels from other countries. And it's cheaper for them to build coal plants than it is to do anything else. So, but there's an expectation that in the next 3-4 years, China and India will stop building coal plants. And, you know, who knows? I mean, that part is exciting. That part is great. But the big pressure on everything is that we now know that we're not doing nearly enough fast enough in order to keep the world from heating and warming so much that we're probably going to do irrevocable damage to the planet. Now, that's the very, very upsetting part. And this kept coming up in the meetings. You know, even with all the things that we're agreeing to, there was another commitment from countries that we're going to triple the use of our renewables in the world by 2030. But even if we do that, that's not nearly enough in order to keep the world from warming beyond the line that they say is 1.5 degrees, 1.5 degrees centigrade more than the world temperature average was at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And I know that sounds really kind of obscure and strange, but there's lots of ways to measure this. And right now we're at about 1.2, 1.3. So the thinking is that if we get past 1.5 degrees, there'll be all these super damaging things that will happen. So we'll lose thousands of species will die, that parts of the world will, you know, weather patterns will shift. Like there will, you know, one thing we're experiencing here in Chicago is that it's been an incredibly dry winter and it's been strangely warm. It was 72 degrees in Chicago a couple days ago. So those kind of things might happen permanently. And when that happens, certain creatures will die. Certain creatures will have to migrate. Certain plants might not survive. Agriculture would shift. You have whole parts of the world that wouldn't be able to grow certain crops. And deserts would grow. And, you know, all of a sudden you have all of these problems. Might not be as huge an issue for us in the United States because we have industrialized agriculture, but in parts of the world where people still have a lot of subsistence farming, and we're talking about billions and billions of people, and the food systems aren't quite as sophisticated as in the United States, we may end up with a lot of starvation. And, you know, we're also seeing things like increased force of hurricanes. Already, there are insurance companies that refuse to insure in Florida and in Louisiana and parts of Alabama. I've heard stories about people trying to buy buildings along the Gulf Coast, and they're told that the insurance company won't cover it because the danger of hurricane damage in the next 5-10 years is too high, and those insurance companies don't want to take on that risk. There's already something like 15% of people in Florida that don't have home insurance because they can't afford it. Home insurance in Florida is like 4 times more than it is in other parts of the country. We have parts of Colorado and California that can't get insured because there's so much danger of wildfire. It's happening. This is real. What we're seeing at things like the negotiations is that countries just can't come together in order to make strong enough decisions. And actually, one of the big blocks to that whole process is the United States, because the United States refuses to take enough refuses to do enough and take enough commitments and do enough. So,
before I get to my next question, I want to just lighten the mood with a quick Simpsons clip that I hope doesn't get our I hope I don't have to cut out of the episode. Let's watch it really quick. It's super short.
Milhouse, you don't care about the environment.
Hey, I am very passionate about the planet.
Say global warming is a myth.
It's a myth. Further study is needed. Whoa!
That's for selling out your belief.
So the reason I showed that is because it seems like some people will step up and, you know, take the stand that this is a problem, but then somebody will punch them in the gut. And by that, I mean, so.
Well, you know, as a regular human just living, it definitely feels that way. I mean, it's really hard. You look at government or you look at organizations like, you know, why don't you guys do stuff? But, you know, we can be doing some things too. I mean, I have actually, my family and I, we've made some changes. We actually, we eat one vegetarian meal a week now, you know, which doesn't sound like much, but that actually is, it's an adjustment, you know, making sure that you're always doing that. We eat one meal of fish every week, you know, which fish tends to be much more sustainable than pork or beef or chicken. We very consciously work to try and keep the heat down in our house, because, you know, we want to consume less. I mean, those are things that you can do. They seem small, but if all of us are doing those things, it makes a difference. You know, if you recycle, if you compost, if you take the train rather than a plane, those are small things that add up. You know, if you can reduce your carbon profile, that can make a difference.
And I want to get back. That's actually a point I had prepped for today. It's almost like the idea of, this may not be a great word, but a lot of people see it this way, is like a sacrifice. I don't personally agree that that's the best word for it, but I don't think it's like inaccurate to say that. But I want to get back to that point. And I will reference Jimmy Carter in saying, you probably already know what I'm going to ask by saying that I'm going to ask about Jimmy Carter. But before I get to that, I wanted to...
Old enough to remember.
Yeah, I'm not old enough to remember. I just happened to see it referenced. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you a question that maybe actually relates to that point you just brought up. A lot of people do see these things, see them, some of the things that you just listed off as a sacrifice that they're not willing to take. Actually, I'll just loop the questions together. I think I can do this. Some of the things you just mentioned, like you say, they're not big things, but they're adjustments you've made. I was referencing Jimmy Carter, I guess, during the particularly cold months of 1977, President Jimmy Carter, and what some call the sweater speech, famously noted how much energy could be saved if Americans simply reduced the thermostat settings for heating their homes. Like you just mentioned, the heat is not rising in your apartment. Sorry, that was a stupid joke to heatrising.net. But I wanted to ask you, how do we, because there was, from what I understand, there was not a great response from Americans on that. They were kind of like, fuck you, I'm not putting on a sweater. How do we get Americans and just people, but it does seem like it is an American issue where we like to live in abundance and surplus and so much comfort. How do we get people to recognize that they should be, you know, pulling back, I guess, a little bit?
You know, I think part of the thing is that when we're told that we should be doing these things, it feels like a scold. And it's like, you know, you're a bad person if you don't do it. But I sort of think about it the same way that I think about that I would make sacrifices for family members. So, you know, my kids or my son, you know, God damn it, I got to shuttle them around to school. You know, I got to take them to stuff. That's sacrifice. You know, my parents are getting older. I need to make sure that I call them and I have to visit them and take them out. That's sacrifice. You know, I mean, that's time that's taken from my life. There's probably other things that I enjoy doing better, but maybe not. You know, I think that I get a certain pleasure and I get a certain, just the knowledge that I'm doing something to contribute makes me feel better. that I'm doing a thing in order to help the world that I live in and the people that I care about. And it seems abstract to say, I'm going to put on a sweater. I mean, part of the problem with the Jimmy Carter speech was, is it wasn't just that it was cold. It's that the price of fuel was high because the Saudis were limiting the supply. And so Americans were pissed off and they thought that Jimmy Carter was being weak. But here we don't really have anybody other than physics and Mother Nature that we're fighting against here. And so what we have an opportunity for is for us all to be together and to work together and to contribute together. When I compost, I feel good that I'm not dumping something into a landfill that is just going to turn into methane and create more greenhouse gases. When I recycle, I feel good that I'm not putting something into a landfill. I do. I feel like I'm adding something to the world. When I wear a sweater rather than turn up the heat, I feel good that I'm not drawing something out of the ground and taking something that isn't necessarily needed. You know, I mean, it can be a good feeling to be self-reliant in the same way that my son loves to work out. He lifts and he feels really good when he hits a personal record. And it's because he's been sacrificing. He's been working hard to get to this place. It's that same kind of feeling. It's the same feeling that you have at the end of a great run. You know, yeah, I did this thing. The same feeling that you have if maybe you volunteer somewhere. Yeah, I did this thing. I helped these people. That's the feeling that I have. And sacrifice actually can be pleasurable. It can be a thing that makes you feel good. And it isn't necessarily a taking from you. It's an adding in a way that you aren't necessarily anticipating.
Yeah. And one of the things you brought up was my idea and how to, I really like what you just had to say about that. And I think that, yeah, I'm going to dwell on that for a while, because even I, somebody who does agree that these are issues, sometimes when I hear, you know, turn the heat down or turn the AC down, I'm like, fuck you, you know, kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, but, man, I feel that way too. You know, yeah, I mean, I love a good hamburger.
Yeah, right.
You know, I love ribs. I mean, you know, all that stuff is good. I'm not going to deny it.
Right.
You know? I'm not a monk.
You know? Yeah.
But I can do these little things around the edges and start with that. You know, it's sort of like, it's like learning to brush your teeth. You know, you just got to get into this habit of doing it. And you brush your teeth, you know, not just to be healthy, but also to not breathe horrible breath on other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I recycle, I compost, you know, those are things that I do. It's like brushing my teeth.
Yeah. And to your point about self-reliance, that's what I really thought was powerful. And maybe that is something, if people can get it in their head that, no, you're actually not only being self-reliant, but you're almost, this is my pitch to preppers, you're almost like prepping, you know, like you're putting off what is a certainty. Which is that, you know, these resources are finite.
So. They are. So anyway, one of the things that's very interesting about this meeting in Dubai is that it's just an endless series of conversations about that.
Yeah.
And not only is the meeting these negotiators, but you end up with, so there were about 30,000 to 40,000 or so people that are negotiators and people from governments. But then there was like another 60,000 that were all largely people from either the climate industry or energy companies that were there all doing deals and talking about how they can grow their business. And that is one of the things that's become very interesting about these meetings is that they've tripled in size. You know, just 3 years ago, there were only about 35,000 people that would go to these meetings. This year, there was close to 100,000. And most of those people were there to network with each other and try and figure out, you know, all different kinds of things. I mean, I met people who were, I shared an Uber with a guy who had just done a deal to build a huge solar field in Morocco. And he was there to go meet with other people about that. I met with people who were there to talk about nuclear energy. I met with people who were there to talk about agriculture. So there's all these different things that are going on at these meetings. And everyone is trying to figure out, okay, you know, how can we do stuff so that it becomes part of the daily living of people around the world?
Yeah. I'm kind of shocked at how many people were there and how long it would last. It really sounded like it was an endurance test on you.
It was. And this meeting was held in an unusually large facility at this giant, they had had a World's Fair in Dubai a few years ago, and they have this huge facility and they don't know what to do with it. And so they used it, and literally to get from one end to the other was about a mile. And so, you know, I'd have these meetings where I'd have about 10 minutes in order to get from one end to the other. And so everyone's constantly rushing back and forth. I did something, I easily did 15,000 steps a day.
Oh yeah.
Wow. And, I was pretty beat. I got a microfracture in one foot and I sprained a toe in another foot.
Damn.
So
the injuries that come with covering the climate.
I was really beat up by the end of the trip. It was fascinating. A lot of people, a lot of amazing things going on.
Yeah. Any other things worth mentioning before we move on to some of the data you sent me? I also have a small video that I wanted to have you shortly narrate that you shared from your time in Dubai. But before we get to the ski Dubai, any other highlights?
I'd say, you know, I think that we're moving into a time where climate discussions are really not so much now that the world has agreed that fossil fuels are the cause of climate change. The real question is, how are we going to fix it? What they call implementation. And the way to fix it is not so much actions as is spending. And the estimate is that it's going to cost somewhere around $9 to $12 trillion a year in order to invest in green technology. Now, that's different than just, you know, writing a check for $9 trillion and it goes away. That's investment. So most of that money should come back and increase. But the idea is that we need to shift how we're spending stuff into these other activities. And there's a lot of different things. You know, for instance, one of the things I learned on this trip that as an American, it never really occurred to me, is Africa doesn't have weather radar that covers the whole country or the whole continent. And the result is that it's very difficult to track the movement of storms and weather patterns. And that doesn't sound like a big deal, but imagine if you're a farmer, you'd like to know what's going to happen, not only today, but knowing patterns, and they don't have tracking in order to know those kind of patterns. And they don't have early warning systems for storms and tornadoes and stuff like that. So imagine if we were to build out a system like that for Africa and the amount of additional money that would be made as a result, because now people could be able to see those things, they can plan accordingly, they could become more profitable. There's a whole series of these kind of infrastructure things that are necessary to be built that could change the world. And that sounds like a really small thing, but it's incredibly consequential.
Yeah, I mean, I check the weather before I just go outside in general. I'm not even a farmer. So, right. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of crazy to think about. You couldn't even really plan out your day or your week, really.
Yeah.
Because there's no, wow, I didn't even know that. That's interesting. A small question before we get to this, just because, have you ever seen those things with like the little thing that's spinning and it takes the temperature and all that stuff?
Weather stations.
Yeah. showing my ignorance. Thank you. I don't know what they're called, but weather stations. Would something like that, obviously they would need power or whatever, but would something like that get them there? Or what is the technology that's required
There's that. You know, they need like Doppler radar systems.
Yeah.
You know, like I mean, we have those in spades. Every TV station has it around the country, and those are all networks.
Is that like I could Google this, but I'm just curious quickly. What is a Doppler? Is it like a tower that's like scan it? Like, I've never thought about that till you just talked about it.
Yeah. Doppler. Well, it's radar.
Yeah.
And Doppler is, the idea that as something is moving away from you or coming closer to you,
right,
as a shift in frequency. So, for instance, when a car goes by, you hear, and that's the frequency of the sound. You can do the same thing with measuring with radar, so you can see how quickly a cloud or a weather system is moving towards you or away from you. And so Doppler radar is radar that measures fast enough at a frequency that can measure the speed at which things are moving. And so now, using that information, you can predict the movement of clouds and weather systems. So if you had a network of Doppler radars across Africa, you would be able to predict the movement of weather systems.
And that's what I was asking about. It seems like the weather stations are relative, like I could set up a weather station in my backyard right now, relatively cheap, but I'm guessing a Doppler radar is like some big tower or something, or what is it?
Yeah. But weather stations positioned around Africa, networked together, would be a major move. I mean, there are some of them, but they don't cover the whole continent, particularly the central part of the continent. And if you had all of that, and if you had all of that data networked together so that you could pull it up and know, that would be a major progression forward.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Ski Dubai, and then we can talk about the data, that the very interesting data you sent along. I'm going to have you narrate this if you don't mind. I mean, I know you're kind of narrating it in the video, but I'd just be interested to hear your thoughts after the fact. What are we looking at? What are our listeners looking at right now?
So this is a mall in Dubai. Dubai loved malls, and this is like one of four or five really huge malls. And you go in, and then all of a sudden you're inside a ski hill. I mean, I'm looking up about halfway up the mountain there,
yeah,
the hill, and there is actually a chairlift, and that is snow. It's all manufactured. But, you know, you walk into this place, and outside it's 85 degrees, and inside it's a chilly, you know, 28, 29 degrees. I mean, it was cold. And they give you, what's funny is when you go, I didn't get skis because I didn't want to ski, but I got a permit to go up the chairlift. They give you this jacket and flimsy pants. And it's, you know, if you live in the Midwest, boy, you know, you'd look at this stuff and you think, this is really pathetic. But the key thing is, they don't give you gloves. You have to pay extra if you want to get gloves.
I can see your breath here. Cold in there.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's really cold. And so you go up this chairlift, and this takes you up about halfway, and I could go all the way up to the top, but halfway they have this chalet. You can see a Kuwaiti flag, or not a UAE flag there in the back. And you go off and to the right there's a chalet, and you can go and just sit and have a hot chocolate and you know, look at people. And
yeah,
that's what I did. And then in order to go down, because I didn't have skis, there's a zip line, and I took a zip line down.
Oh yeah. And is that in the video?
And you know, basically the people hanging out at this place were a lot of Emirati teenage kids. You know, this is what you do. You go to the mall, and then you go hang out in the chalet and ski down the hill. And this is a, you know, first off, this is cool. Let's just be straight up about it. I mean, it's pretty amazing. It's an amazing thing to see.
Yeah.
but it is an incredible energy suck. I can't imagine how much energy it takes to keep that cold 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, 366 in the case of this year, and then manufacture all that snow. And I mean, wow. But if I lived in Dubai, I'd probably go. I mean, you know, it's a strange, unusual, you know, if you're hot and there's sand and it's dusty all the time, this is a respite. It actually is pretty neat. I have family that live in Cairo. There's a similar one in Cairo, and they told me that they've gone and they think it's pretty cool. But it is a very strange thing that really emphasizes that everything about Dubai is entirely manufactured. You know, it is a world of concrete and air conditioning. And it really would not exist without just an enormous, enormous amount of energy. So, you know, you kind of wonder, how does a country like that continue to prosper in the future? You know, I don't know. They definitely, that's the view, that big picture on the right. That's the view from the top of the Burj Al Dubai, which is the tallest building in the world. And, you know, you look at all those little buildings there, those, the small buildings, those are like 40 stories tall. You know, it gives you a sense of how big everything is. And the Burj Al Dubai, I didn't go up to the top because it costs something like $200 to go to the top. And I really didn't want to spend $200 to go to the top of a building. But I went to the mall at the base, and the mall is ridiculous. There's 1,200 stores in the mall. You know, I mean, that just everything about Dubai is just so much stuff to buy and do. And
I think this is a great picture. It just shows you the cityscape and how it contrasts.
Yeah, you see the Burj right there in the middle, which is like 800 meters tall. I mean, that's really, really tall. I mean, it's a crazy city. It is made entirely for the wealthy. It's very hard to get around if you don't have a car, which is a lot of people. I mean, there's an enormous number of people that are workers there from other countries. Like the population of all of the Emirates, is the number of Emirati citizens is like 1.5 million, but the number of guest workers is like 4 or 5 million.
Yeah. And I don't know how much truth there is, but there's always talk about, like, first of all, I just have to say, this looks like an evil villain's lair, the Burj Khalifa. Have you ever heard the talk, to your point that you just brought up, and we can move on to data, but I've heard that like a lot of this skyline allegedly is built by like slave labor.
Pretty close. I don't know that you would call it slave labor, but I, you know, a lot of the people who go there from the Philippines and India and Pakistan and African countries, you know, they arrive and they have to, once they get a job, they have to turn over their passport. And where they live are in these big dormitories that are owned by the construction companies. So, you know, your whole life is basically governed by these countries, these companies. And you go into a certain amount of debt when you work for the companies. You know, they pay your uniform and your food. And so you have to work there. And then when you're done, you know, maybe they give you your passport back and you can go back. They've been trying to change some of the laws in the Emirates about that. I don't know how successful they are. It's not an open society. So it's not like there's a free press that's reporting on whether or not this is actually happening. You know, they have a real security service that throws people in jail if you ask too many questions. So that, I mean, it is. The sheen of it as a visitor, especially from the West, is really glittery and nice. And you stay in these beautiful hotels. Then when you start digging a little bit, and I stayed in kind of a working class neighborhood, working middle class neighborhood, which is where my Airbnb was. And it was almost entirely Indians and Russians. And, you know, it's a very, certainly everyone had showers in their own apartments, but it was not the American standard of living. And it was a little less. And you, if you're not working, you're not valuable. So like, you don't see families, you know, you don't see kids. There are neighborhoods that have that stuff, but those are very wealthy neighborhoods that are somewhere else. And, you know, from what I understand is that once you make your money, you leave, you don't come back. So that's pretty much how Dubai operates. It's a very strange place to be when you're holding a meeting that is ostensibly about helping the world, because so much of the city is not about helping the world.
Yeah. I got to ask another Dubai question. How did you get food and stuff? Sorry, that just came up. I was like,
well, at the meeting convention space, they had all these kiosks set up all over the place where you could eat. But what I did for my breakfast in the morning is I found a grocery store and I got some food and I kept it there. And I would usually, one of the great things about Arab countries is they love fruit juices. So I would always have some fruit juice in the morning. I'd have some yogurt and I'd buy fruit. And that's what I'd have for breakfast. And then in the evenings, there are lots of these street side in the neighborhood that I was living in, lots of these street side restaurants. So I had Turkish food one night. I would usually have chicken biryani at some other place. You know, Chinese food, lots of Chinese people there. So there was lots of very good Chinese food. So that was pretty great. And it was usually really cheap. Like I could have some really good chicken biryani and a drink. And the drink that I like a lot is lemon mint, where basically they make lemonade and then they put lots of little pieces of mint in it. And I would have a lemon mint, you know, that whole thing would cost me maybe $5. And it was a very filling meal. And that's what I would do every day.
Very nice. Very nice. That's so cool. I'm looking forward to the next time you go to one of these meetings.
Yeah, well, Baku is the next one. And the big worry about Baku is that it's not a city big enough. It's only a city of about 2 million. And it's not a city big enough to really handle 100,000 people that are going to come for a meeting.
Yeah.
All of the major hotels have already been reserved out for the meeting. I haven't gotten a hotel room because soon after, in mid-January, the government shut down the hotel reservation process because they're worried that all the hotels will be sold to rich Westerners and people from poorer countries won't be able to afford to go. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do. Turns out my dry cleaner has family in Baku and he offered to talk to his family to let me stay. So that would be interesting. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. It'll be really interesting.
Yeah. Well, folks, you can stay tuned. Another plug at heatrising.net. We'll close out the show with looking at some data, shall we?
Yeah.
I just wanted to show quickly who this data is from. Bloomberg, it looks like.
Bloomberg has a research group called Bloomberg NEF. And this was paid for by the Business Council for Sustainable Energy, which is basically a business group that wants everyone to use green tech.
Yeah. And one of the pieces of data you showed me, I tried to hold back my jokes. You said we're trying to eliminate coal. I said, hey, what did I do? I'm just joking. This is an interesting graph here. I thought it was super interesting because it looks like we had a dip recently in our use of coal. I don't mean to focus too much on that, though. Break this down. Why do you find this interesting? You had noted this slide for me.
Well, this is cost of electricity. This is cost of electricity. So the gray line that you see there is the cost of coal. And there was a dip in 2019 to 2020, but not really much. And it went back up again. And basically, the cost of coal is higher than the cost of using wind, which is that blue line, the cost of solar, which is that yellow line. And then that light blue line is what's called combined cycle gas turbine, which is the most popular kind of natural gas system that's being installed now. So combined cycle gas turbines are a little bit cheaper than wind and solar. But long term, it does seem like solar and wind costs are going down significantly. And gas is really cheap in the United States because we have a surplus of it. We produce a lot of it. Nobody's really quite sure how long that's going to last. But definitely the cost of solar and wind continue to go down. So not only is it good for the environment, it's good for the pocketbook to use solar and wind. In fact, if you live in a lot of states, you can buy, you know, solar electricity as part of your, you can, you know, go to these companies and buy solar rather than your local utility. And oftentimes it's a lot cheaper than what your utility would be. And this right here is why, because utilities continue to use coal plants because that's what they have and that's what they own and they want to use that. But they have these other newer companies that are selling just solar, and solar is a lot cheaper than coal. You can see, I mean, it's almost a half to a quarter less in cost. That's really significant.
Yeah. Yeah, that's insane. That's insane. And I just have to say this just because you meant the black line is coal, right? You said the gray line is coal.
I'm sorry. Well, I thought it was dark gray, but yes, black.
Okay. Just making sure. Just
yeah,
making
the
sure.
Not gray is gas. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. That is super interesting. And so you're saying that it's actually, just to put that back in a bottle, it's actually cheaper to go green. This is what this is showing.
Yeah, yeah. And average citizens, you know, you can find these companies that will sell you solar electricity to replace your utility. And utilities have to carry that solar electricity to your home. You pay you pay both companies. You end up paying the solar electricity company for your electricity, and you have to pay the utility for the right to use their wires. You get a bill usually from both places. But you end up saving quite a bit of money overall.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Any other thoughts on this? Slide.
This trend is just going to continue, and you know the world is installing a lot more solar and wind because of this trend. Utility companies don't like solar and wind because they already built all these power plants. And they want to use the power plants until they run out of value for them. So that's why utility companies tend to resist solar and wind, because they want to continue using the coal and gas plants that they built a long time ago.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of crazy, and feel free to correct me if I'm like wrong on this or if you disagree, but I think it's crazy. And I'll move to our next slide. Like my uncle, for example, recently got solar, and it's awesome because I think they're actually paying him at this point because his roof is so large.
He installed it. Yeah, you can do that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting. It kind of reminds me of like home grow and that, which I'm talking about cannabis, and that it seems like, so like Ameren still is, he still has like paperwork he deals with the power company, and they actually take power from his house, which I think is cool. I just thought it was notable that like the power company is even still involved. Again, I think it's cool because they're able to like take his surplus, if you will, and distribute it. So that's the cool part about it.
Yeah.
But I just like, it's interesting how the company even is able to like work their way into that. You know what I mean? I don't know if my question is
typically
clear.
If you get solar panels installed, unless you add a giant battery to your house, the problem is that the times when most people use their electricity is at the beginning of the day and the end of the day. And that middle part is when the most solar is produced. So unless you have a battery, and most people don't get batteries,
right,
you're not going to serve yourself. So you're still going to need the utility company. You could sell them the solar in the middle of the day, which they'll gladly take, but then at night and the beginning and the end of the day, when your demand is highest, you still need them to supply it to you.
Gotcha. Yeah. That makes sense. I think maybe I the way you just said that makes so much more sense. And I guess where I was coming from, it was just interesting. Like you say, some of these companies will oppose it, but then when you install it in your house, they're like, well, wait a minute, we need that.
Right. Oh yeah. They want it.
Right.
They definitely want it. Yeah. So if you want to get 100% off the grid, you got to add a battery.
Yeah.
And that's another big cost. And, you know, not everybody can handle that. You know, it's, you got to spend $30,000-$40,000 in order to get the solar panels and the battery. And, you know, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. If you can tell, I'm trying to make a pitch to the preppers. I feel like those are the group that tend to be preppers are the group that tend, and maybe I'm casting with a wide brush, but they tend to be, you know, kind of right-leaning, anti-climate change and stuff. I'm like, no, lean into it. Make yourself self-reliant. Don't depend on the big companies.
Like, oh, yeah. There's a real case to be made for that. Absolutely. Yeah.
So 63, slide 63, I want you to break this one down as well. There's a lot to this one, I feel.
Oh, man. Yeah. Carbon capture projects. So, you know, what you're looking at here, so carbon capture is just gathering all the extra CO2 that goes into the sky. And what you're looking at is there's like basically no carbon capture projects that are underway. And then all of a sudden by 2025, there should be a ton more. In 2030, there should be, you know, way more. And this is million metric tons of CO2. And to give you a sense of how much CO2, right now we're putting, I think, somewhere around 400 or 500 million metric tons of CO2 into the air every year. So by 2030, we wouldn't even be doing half of what needs to be done in order to keep pace. But what you see here, all these different colors are different ways, different projects are talking about gathering CO2 and then turning it in different things. The most common thing is taking it and pumping it into the ground in old gas and oil wells, which is fine. It can stay there for a million years and nobody would know about it, just like oil. And these are all the different ways in which they're talking about it. Ammonia, hydrogen, which is one of the big ones you see, the purple on the bottom of 2030. That is fertilizer production. A lot of people don't know the way most fertilizer is produced is by using natural gas as a feedstock. And so when you create that fertilizer, you're creating nitrogen, and one of the things that gases off is CO2. There's a lot of CO2 that comes out of fertilizer production. And this is the fertilizer that's, you know, the ammonia fertilizer that's used on farms. And so if you can capture all that CO2 that comes off of fertilizer production, that would be a major thing. Power generation, you know, there's a lot of CO2 that comes out of coal, burning coal, natural gas processing. You know, that's where you're pulling natural gas out of the ground. There's a lot of methane and CO2 that leaks out of that stuff. Ethanol production is a major, major producer of CO2 that we have in Illinois and the Midwest. One of the big struggles right now is that there are companies in the Midwest and that have an idea of building these, using old pipelines and building new pipelines and taking the natural gas from ethanol plants and then putting into old coal mines in Illinois. That there's been a tremendous amount of grassroots resistance across the Midwest against these pipelines because people are concerned that if the CO2 pipelines rupture, CO2 is heavier than air, it'll travel along the ground and then suffocate people and kill them, because it's odorless and colorless. You know, that something needs to be done in order to add maybe a smell to it, like you have for natural gas. There's something that's added to consumer natural gas so that you can smell it. That smell is not natural. Or some sort of federal standards. And that's something that the government has really, really been struggling with. Before we're going to have a real solution for that, we have to have a way in which we can pipe this CO2 around in order to be able to put it into the ground in the United States.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about the Because you mentioned objections to the CO2 pipelines, and I'm thinking, what the hell could be the objections? And we got to figure that out.
People are very afraid of it. Illinois and Iowa and South Dakota and Minnesota, a whole bunch of projects have been canceled because of local opposition. There needs to be a national solution, and it's the sort of thing that Congress needs to get involved in. But because Congress has been so just stuck, none of these things are being addressed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Any other, this is a big one. Any other thoughts on this slide here?
No, I mean, what you see here is great if it can happen, but we need to do twice as much, three times as much. I mean, not only do we need to stop putting new carbon into the air, we need to start removing carbon from the air. So, you know, what you see here is billions of dollars of investment. You need many more billions. You need to triple what you see here. We're not going nearly fast enough if we're going to stop global warming.
Yeah. This next one I found very, very interesting. I hope I read this one right. I mean, let's just start here, I guess. Am I correct in saying we're almost, in 2023, we're almost to a point where 50% of our vehicle fuel is renewable? Is that true?
No, it's natural gas.
So damn it, I'm reading things wrong. Renewable. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is using natural gas. There used to be a lot of natural gas vehicles that were used, buses and things you'd see like that. But now renewable vehicles are really growing. I think that this isn't nearly as interesting. I think a couple slides later is the that's the end. What's that last slide there?
This one?
Renewable diesel supply. No, it's not that one. I'm trying to find. I know I shared something with you, and I'm trying to find the right one.
Yeah.
Here it is. Slide 67, the one right before it.
Perfect. There we go.
So, I think that this is really fascinating. The U.S. electrical vehicle sales, you can see it's just exploded. And, we're in 2023, we're probably going to have like seven times as many electric cars sold as in 2020. Now, 1.4, 1.5 million vehicles, I think we're selling something like 15 million vehicles a year. So, this is only 0.1% to 5% of the total vehicles sold in the United States, but you can see it's growing very, very fast. And what's the company that's growing the fastest? You see Tesla in there, that big blue chunk there. But there's a lot of other really great cars that are coming out on the market. I went to the Chicago Auto Show a couple weeks ago, and I was really impressed. I mean, there are some, the Mustang Mach-E is an amazing car. Not only is it an amazing car, it looks fun, it looks cool, and it's pretty well priced. I mean, you can get one for about $38,000. The new Kia EV6, which is basically a very sporty, cool looking SUV, three row seating. Wow. What a cool car. There's so many things that are great about it. If I had a bunch of small kids, I would probably want to get one. One of the things that I really liked about all the Kias too, is they all have a 110 volt jack in the back. So you can, if you had a TV, you just plug it right in. That just seems like of course, if you're driving around a big giant battery, you should be able to plug into your TV, right?
Yeah.
I think that we're really on the edge of something really big happening. My car is, I drive an old Subaru. It's a little over 10 years old. And a lot of the problems that it's having now are its engine. And I'm really getting tired of it. If I had an electric car, I wouldn't have those problems.
Right.
It leaks a lot of oil now.
Yeah.
A belt broke the other day. Those aren't problems you'd have with an electric vehicle that lasts longer, supposedly. So, you know, a couple more, I'm going to make my car last a couple more years, but, you know, I could see EVs being a really good solution for a lot of people. And I think that it's about to happen.
Yeah. And as far as infrastructure goes, my same uncle has a Tesla as well. And it's interesting to me. One of the things that my dad will give him shit about, he'll say, well, it'll die when you're driving across the parking lot. And he's like, dude, it lasts me 250 miles. And he's like, but it takes forever to fill up. My dad, I don't know why, he just wants to prove him wrong on electric vehicles. And he's like, dude, it takes like 15 minutes to get over 50%. And typically when I stop, I'll go in, I'll get a drink, I'll stretch a little bit, I'll use the restroom. And just about there, you're talking 5 to 10 minutes. So you can wait an extra 5 for your battery. He makes a very convincing case for an electric vehicle.
So the one of the things that we're really, really close on with electric is, you know, the batteries right now have, they use a lot of water, and that is in order to be able to move. I don't really entirely understand the chemistry, but in the next 5-7 years, the expectation is to move to what's called a solid state battery. And has a different chemical composition. And the expectation is that a solid state battery would probably hold 3 to 4 times the charge of existing batteries and would charge twice as fast, if not more. So I think that we're really, really close. If you're going to buy an electric vehicle, I would get a lease, because I think that we're really close to moving to this different kind of battery. You know, so if you could imagine, if you had a car that had a 600-mile range and you could charge it, you know, 50% in 5 minutes, you know, you know, that really makes internal combustion engines look kind of lame. And I think that we're really close on that. Like, there's going to be some things that are going to change that are going to make gas vehicles seem like horse and buggies. You know, it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, I think one of the things is, and I know this is appealing to maybe the macho side, but, you know, you're seeing these electronic vehicles, for lack of better words, smoke performance vehicles. Oh,
yeah, their torque is incredible.
Yeah, like a sport, like that vehicle you just described earlier, which is the Kia. Some people have said, yeah, they've been blown off the line by soccer moms in their electric vehicle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and if you're driving a Mustang Mach-E, you know, you're going almost as fast as a Lamborghini. I mean, you know, the torque in these cars are so high. You don't have gear shifting. So, you know, things move pretty quickly.
And I think to your point before we, I wanted to give you space if there's anything else on these. Because from what I understand, the way it's able to get so much torque is because each wheel is tracked kind of by like the computer in the car per se, and it can track it down to like a decimal. In other words, like you can put the pedal to the metal and it will put it to the max and the tires will not slip because it knows just the right amount. And if they start to slip, it'll kind of tear back on it much quicker than a combustion fueled car is. And another example, I guess I could give just for folks in Illinois, I've heard that like electronic vehicles, like if you hit black ice, for example, it responds so much, not that maybe the outcome is any different, but the way that it responds is so much quicker than a regular car because everything is electronic. I thought that was an interesting.
That is interesting. I don't know that. But I mean, another aspect is that because it's an electric motor, the basic torque of it has no limitation, whereas a gas engine has limitations of physics.
Yeah,
in terms of how much output it can have, whereas a electric motor is only limited by the amperage of the battery, and the amperages of these batteries are very, very high. It's sort of like, I don't know if anybody does RC cars, mm-hmm. but my son used to do this, you know, we would go get like a 1500 amperage battery, milliamp battery, and we'd plug that in and we'd drive it around and then we'd go really fast. And then we'd go get a 3000 milliamp battery and then it would just cook, you know, it was really fast. So that's basically what you're seeing with these electric cars, but on a much bigger basis.
Yeah. And I wanted to give you some space on this. One thing I felt like we should point out is before I give you the space is like these categories are really expanding. Yes, Tesla has always dominated, but check out these other brands getting into the game.
Yeah. You know, watch out for companies like Geely, which is a Chinese company that also owned Volvo. You know, they're growing very fast. Kia, Toyota, you know, I think Ford is going to have some really, really cool cars. I saw some really neat GM cars that are in pre-production at the auto show. I think those are going to be really great. I personally feel a lot more comfortable buying a car from a traditional automobile company for a whole number of reasons. So I'm looking forward to, you know, what GM has in the future. I mean, I would really... I've there's a lot of build issues with Teslas and I'm not so crazy about how they pulled a lot of stuff from you when you buy a car. You know, I think Ford and Kia are really, really doing cool stuff. And the Hyundai Ioniq 5 and the Ioniq 6 are really, really cool cars. You know, I think there's a lot that's going to be coming onto the market. That's really fun and awesome.
Yeah.
Not sacrifice.
In some cases, more, like we were just talking about. You can go faster.
Yeah.
You plug things in. Well, hey, last time we talked, I didn't think about this until just now. Governor Pritzker had put, I don't know the right word, he did not sign into law this nuclear bill that came his way. But I think between the last time we spoke and now, he did sign legislation. Are you able to talk about this? Sorry, I didn't prep you on this.
I mean, Illinois has a long history of nuclear power, which I personally think is a good thing. Nuclear power tends to be extremely well managed, very clean. You do end up with the nuclear waste, and we do need to figure out what to do with that. And that's a whole other story in and of itself. But nuclear power doesn't create any CO2, creates an enormous amount of electricity, and can be a real solution for our global warming problem. And, the bill that was finally approved and signed by Pritzker, allows smaller nuclear power plants. I mean, one of the problems is that most of the nuclear power plants in the past that have been built have been these mega, you know, thousands of megawatt facilities. And Pritzker is proposing, or the bill that Pritzker to sign would create these smaller, like 400, 300 megawatt plants that would go on sites of closed coal plants. So you already have all the electricity infrastructure going to that location. You build a new nuclear power plant in that location. And there's a lot of technology that has been developed in the last 30 years since the moratorium was entered, where these plants are safer, they're cheaper to build. They're building these in other countries, and building them in Poland. They've been building them in Japan. And so I think it's a good solution for the United States. And by the way, Illinois is where the first nuclear reactors were. You know, the in Stagg Field, when they split the atom for the first time, that was at the University of Chicago, that was a nuclear reactor. And then they built other ones. So Illinois has a long, long history with nuclear power. We should keep doing it.
Yeah. And I can't find the most recent figures, but from 2015, here's a look at the nuclear capacity. And Illinois was top in the United States.
Yeah, there's... there actually was a really good graph in this thing that I sent you that shows it, how the Midwest is so different. If I can find it real quick, maybe I can't. But yeah, oh, here it is. Yep. Slide number 19, page 20.
All right.
And if you can.
Oh, wait. 19.
Yep, there it is. So what you're looking at there, PJ, these are the different sectors of electricity in the United States. The United States is broken up into different sectors. And red is when you're using nuclear power. And PJM, Chicago and Northern Illinois is part of PJM, which includes Northern Illinois and Ohio and Pennsylvania, which is where the most, and Maryland, which is where the most nuclear power plants are. And you can see, you know, we're doing an average of 800 terawatts a year in PJM, which is a lot of electricity. And you know, maybe 40% of that is nuclear in our sector. And you look at the rest, there's not a whole lot of other places that have that much nuclear. The Southeast does, but there's a bunch of power plants in Tennessee and Georgia, South Carolina. And then MISO is Midwest ISO, which is Southern Illinois and Iowa and Missouri. And then there's a few other nuclear power plants in Illinois, and that's part of the red that you see there. The fast sloping part that you see, the black, that's the bottom of each of those, that's coal. So you can see how coal is just falling off really fast in all these parts of the country. And the gray part sits in the middle, that's natural gas. So natural gas is growing very quickly. And, you know, a little bit of blue that you see, that's renewables. And so you can see renewables are growing a lot in Midwest ISO because we have a lot of wind and solar. You know, ERCOT is Texas. You can see that renewables are growing a lot in Texas. But PJM, which includes Northern Illinois, you know, look at all that nuclear.
I mean, it looks like we, you know, the Southeast, PJM, and MISO, did you say?
Midwest ISO. Like,
we run Midwest, this country.
Yeah, we do. Well, I mean, in terms of the size, I mean, New York, that's just New York State is its own section.
Okay.
But
I was surprised at California. You'd think with just with how many people there are and with how green they seem to be.
Yeah, they are. They are very green. Well, you know, that's just one state. California is just one state.
Sure.
You know,
that's PJM a good point.
Is a lot of big states.
Right.
So
a bunch of different areas.
Pennsylvania, Ohio, Northern Illinois, you know, that's a lot going on there.
That makes sense. Cool. Well, we've covered a lot of bases today. I appreciate your time. And I just have two last, I think there'll be quick questions for you. The low gas prices during the last administration, there's a dial in the presidential office where they can turn up and turn down the gas prices, right?
Yeah. You know, gas prices are never going back down again. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, part of it is inflation. But the other big issue is that the war with Ukraine and Russia, you know, Russia is one of the world's largest suppliers of oil. And so long as Russia continues this war, there's going to be a constraint of oil coming from them. And that's just the way it's going to be. You know, I mean, I suppose we could settle the war with Russia, but that would mean that Ukraine would basically have to give in and would become an under thrall of Putin. And I'm not sure that it's worth $2.50 gas for that. You know, we're never going to see... We're probably never going to see $2.50 gas. We're never going to see $1.98 gas again. You know, that's just a fact of life. And probably as we continue moving more and more green, you know, gas prices will go up, I'm going to guess, because it's going to be less and less profitable for companies to be drilling in the ground.
Interesting. Interesting. Thank you for addressing that. Yeah, the main joke I was trying to make is that's more due to economic factors. The president does not control the gas prices, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of weird things that are going on right now. There was a major story in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago, or Bloomberg a couple weeks ago, about how oil oil companies have had record profits in the last year, and yet oil company stocks are declining. And what's going on is the market is pricing in the expectation that green energy is going to be pushing these oil companies out of business. And oil companies are, you know, they're making lots of money, but their future is getting dimmer and dimmer as time goes by.
Yeah. Well, my last question, I do believe is an easy one. I'm just curious, because I appreciate your work. Do you ever plan to get any help, man? You seem like you're a one-man band, and I, you know, only ask so that you can, since this is a platform that you might be able to get people that are interested in helping.
Yeah. You know, well, if there's anybody that I'm looking for, somebody that has right now I'm working on a database project. So if there's anybody out there that has some database knowledge, I'd love to building a database, searchable databases and front ends for websites. That would be really great. Love to have your help if you can help me with that. I mean, a lot of the work is very prosaic. You know, it's not necessarily sexy. There's no stakeouts or anything like that.
Sure.
You know, so it's a lot of very basic things like that.
Lots of walking.
Knows a lot about database front ends and database management on websites. I'd love to have your help.
Absolutely. That lots of walking comment was a joke about Dubai. There's lots of walking involved with this line of work. No, but I asked that question at the end because if anybody's still listening, it's people that really do care about this topic. And so I wanted to give you the space in case you needed help.
Thank you very much.
That'd yeah. Great. Yeah. Yeah. Folks, heatrising.net. That's probably where, if you would like to get in contact with Mike, you could visit like the about page or something like that. Reach out. And Mike, any last thoughts before we go?
That's it. Please subscribe. Love to have you as a reader.
Yeah. So folks, once again, heatrising.net. You go to the page and in the top right-hand corner, see a subscribe button. And that will allow you to receive the news right off the wire, as they say in the news business, right?
That's it.
So, Mike, I always appreciate the fact that you're willing to sit down with me to have these long-form, nuanced conversations. Just wanted to let you know that I appreciate you before we close out.
I love to talk about it. Love your show. It's really great.
Thanks. Well, folks, I hope you found as much value in this conversation as I did. And remember, folks, it's not a sacrifice. It's something that, lean into it.
Helping your family.
That's right. Helping your family and your fellow neighbor. Well, folks, we'll see you in the next episode of The Coal Memo. Take care.